I was still awaiting a scholarship.
Tell me your name again, she said.
Martin Ganda, I said.
I know you,
she responded. Your pen pal emailed me a few months ago.
Caitlin?
I asked.
Yes,
Rebecca said. She got in touch to see if I could help find Zimbabwean sponsors. I wish we could. Caitlin had never told me this, but I didn't let on.
Oh, yes, of course,
I said. We're not giving up.
Nor should you, she added. I was recently on the phone with Villanova's office. The recruiter was raving about you. Come to the orientation. This way you'll be prepared when they do find the money.
Those words instilled such hope, as if the angels were clapping for me too. I asked Tekla if it was okay for me to go to Harare that weekend to attend the course.
You must, she said.
Alois and Sekai once again greeted me warmly.
When you do go to America, don't forget everyone here, Alois said.
That would be impossible, I replied. I'd never been to the American embassy before, but it was like they planted what I imagined was a building from New York City or Washington, D.C. in the middle of Harare. I walked through the wrought iron gates and felt like I was suddenly transported to the States. Even the doorknobs were different, big, heavy, and polished. Proud. I entered the building and walked up to the security guards, who asked me for identification. My name was on a list, and the guard pointed down a long hallway to a room where the orientation was taking place. I saw a white woman with long blonde hair holding a clipboard and asked her where I could find Rebecca Mano.
My Mano, she said.
I was shocked. I was certain Rebecca was black. When we spoke on the phone, her Shona was impeccable. As I was still reeling, she asked if I got my Magixin, Shona for vaccination injection. She spoke my native tongue fluently. I had just started wandering around the room when Rebecca called everyone to take seats and explained that the orientation was to prepare us for some of the bigger cultural differences between Zimbabwe and America.
Money is quite different, for starters, she said. U.S. bills are all the same size, so make sure you look at the number in the corners, she explained.
I knew this already. This was going to be a breeze. But then she handed around coins. They were totally confusing. She said the 10-cent coin was smaller than the 5-cent one, but was worth more, and was also called a dime. I started taking notes. There were about 20 other students there, all going to the U.S. for the first time. Most were black kids from Harare, whose parents were paying for everything, but a few came from far away, like me. I was the only one awaiting a scholarship. Next, Rebecca introduced Freedom, who was already studying in the U.S.
Americans are funny about food, he began. To start, there's so much you wouldn't believe your eyes. A hamburger is the size of your plate. Everyone laughed. This was something we all wanted to see. If you have a roommate, you don't have to offer them any of your food, he continued. And if your roommate leaves food in the fridge, you have to ask permission before you eat it.
We all started laughing again. In Zimbabwe, everyone shares. I wouldn't eat if you weren't eating too. That would be rude.
I learned this the hard way, Freedom continued. My roommate reported me for eating his leftovers.
One girl raised her hand.
Why?
She asked. Leftovers means you are full.
Everyone agreed, including Freedom. That's how we feel here, he said. But America is different.
This was important information. Freedom next talked about clothes. Same deal. Americans don't share their clothes. For us, there is no mine or yours. I could wake up and my mom would be wearing the t-shirt Caitlin gave me, or my brother would have on the shoes I often wore. It wasn't a big deal. In Shona, we say the little we have, we share. Even at Marist, everyone shared. Some people would bring cans of fish from home because we didn't get fish at school. Or they would bring peanut butter. If my peanut butter runs out, I'd say, I'm getting peanut butter from your jar. No one cared. Rebecca introduced another student who told us about parties and how everyone drinks beer. That was shocking. We didn't do that at Marist. Our parties were alcohol-free. At that point, I saw myself as someone who would never drink in my life.
I'd had one sip of beer and thought it tasted nasty. Many students at the orientation were already over 21, so this guy said, "Be careful. Buying alcohol for underage U.S. students can get you in serious trouble." "What kind?" someone asked. "You can be arrested and deported," he said. I jotted that down too. American greetings were another topic. If someone asks, "How's it going?" the answer to that question is, "Fine," Freedom explained. No one has time for anything else. This was fascinating. We have 6 different ways of saying hello in Shona, each appropriate for a specific time of day. Mangwanani means good morning and is usually the start of a 5-minute conversation like, "How did you sleep? What are you going to do today?" In the States, Freedom said people just say hi and keep going. I'd taken 4 pages of notes by the time the American ambassador arrived. He told us he went to Harvard with Edson Zwobgo, the first black Zimbabwean to go to that famous university. He eventually became a professor in the United States, the ambassador said. "People often talk about the American dream. Edson had one, and now you do too." By July, I hadn't heard anything from Caitlin or Anne, and I was starting to get nervous. I sent them a quick note, using all caps to stay positive. Somehow these large letters helped. I told them I was waiting patiently, which I was truly trying to do, and to please keep me updated on any news. I signed it with a string of X's and O's, and then Martin, 2003 undergraduate American University student.
June 2003. Caitlin. By the end of April, we had heard from all of the colleges Martin applied to. 5 accepted him, 3 offered him partial scholarships, and 2 offered him a place but no money. The last letter came in from NYU, another rejection. That was it. We had reached the end of the road. I crumpled it up in the driveway and burst into tears. I'd failed my friend. I promised him we would find a way for him to study in the United States, but it felt impossible. The only thing I could do was work even harder and start saving money to bring him here myself. "More bad news," I shouted as I entered the house. "What now?" my mom asked. I threw the paper ball onto the kitchen counter. "That's it," I said. "It's over, Mom." "Not yet," she said. I knew she was working on other avenues. She had reached out to local politicians and the papers. She was even organizing a bake sale to raise money. "I sent Rebecca Mano an email this morning," she continued. "I'm going to see if we can get him here on a visitor's visa." "How does that help?" I asked. "He can accept the spot at Villanova, and then we'll keep working once he's here to raise money to cover the fees," she said. I knew this was a last resort for my parents. They were paying for Richie to go to Temple, and I was planning to continue at the community college in the fall. In the meantime, my high school graduation was coming up, and my mom wanted to take me dress shopping. I didn't have the heart to tell her I didn't care about a new dress, or graduation for that matter. I couldn't wait to be done with high school. The day my mother and I planned to go shopping, she surprised me. "I wrote a letter to Father Dobbin this morning," she said, sliding a piece of paper in front of me. I knew he was the president of Villanova because my mother had been talking about him lately. He was her last shot at a miracle. I wanted to make sure he realized what a big mistake Villanova was making by not giving Martin a scholarship, she said, as I began to read. "Dear Father Dobbin, we are contacting you as a last resort for helping a young man from Zimbabwe. Martin Ganda is a 20-year-old from Mutare, Zimbabwe, and has been our daughter's pen pal since 1997. Our daughter initially paid for Martin's schooling fees with her babysitting money, until his family became destitute from declining economic conditions. At that point, we took over the support and tuition for Martin and his family. Martin has been accepted at Villanova University for fall 2003. Unfortunately, our daughter and son are both college students, which means we are unable to finance Martin's college education as well. Your colleagues at VU have been very supportive of our plight, yet we still do not have any funds. Martin graduated from Nyanga High School with honors last fall. He secured a part-time teaching position and is currently working in a tourist's cottage to earn money for his family. Father, we know you have a very heavy load of responsibilities, and we would never ask for our own children. But this young man has nothing. We are his only hope. Do you have any connections or programs seeking students like Martin to sponsor? Would you know of any other avenues for us to pursue? Please, explore any resources you may have to help our dear young friend. His information should be available in admissions, and I have copies of the emails, including a story of Martin's sad life and how he touched our hearts. Thank you in advance for your help. Sincerely, Richard and Anne Neville Stoichitz. Tears were streaming down my face as I read my mom's last-ditch effort. "Send it," I said. "Let's bless it first," she said. She placed it in the stamped envelope and held one end as I took the other. We both closed our eyes and said a silent prayer. I leaned down and kissed it. For good luck. In July, we had our bake sale. We raised $350. I was working full-time at the pizza parlor and picking up any babysitting jobs I could, and had only saved another $900. I had another $28,750 to go. Then, I got an email from Martin saying he was waiting patiently. But I could tell that even Martin's optimism was wavering. "How am I going to tell him that it might not happen?" I asked my mom, once again fighting back tears. She stayed quiet as she considered my question. Usually, she'd snap right back and chastise me for a bad attitude. She'd say, "Don't give up. That's not going to solve this problem. Save all your energy for figuring out how we can do it, not how we can't." Today was different. "We'd better start thinking about how to break it to him," she said, her voice barely a whisper.
July 2003. Martin. I was surprised that Caitlin and Anne hadn't responded to my email right away. I assumed they were very busy. I was too. It was peak tourist season and the bed and breakfast was booked solid every single day. It was hard to take time off, but I had to go fill out a few more forms at the embassy so I'd be ready to go when we found the scholarship money. Rebecca was helping me figure out a visa without a benefactor. It was very difficult. There was an internet cafe not far from Alois and Sekai's house. I checked in my first morning there on my way to the U.S. Embassy to see if there was any news. There was an email from Villanova dated July 15, 2003. I was trembling as I clicked it open.
July 2003. Caitlin. I woke up startled. My mother was screaming so loud, I thought something terrible must have happened. It was a rare day off, and I had been out with Damon until 1 a.m. playing pool. After our big fight that spring, Damon really backed off and gave me space. I appreciated it, but he was really happy when school was over, as I had more time for him. I was happy too. I heard another shriek and looked at my clock. It was 9:15 a.m., I stumbled downstairs to make sure everything was okay. That's when I heard her say, "That's fantastic news!" I had to tap her on the shoulder to let her know I was there, waiting to hear what on earth was so exciting on a Thursday morning. "Caitlin, they did it!" she cried. Then she told me the story at breakneck speed. "Father Dobbin marched my letter down to Candace, placed it on her desk, and said, 'Martin Ganda.' Candace said, 'Yes, Father Dobbin,' He's an extraordinary young man, but we don't have the money for a full scholarship. And then Father Dobbin tapped his finger on her desk and said, "Find the money." That was in June, and this is Candace on the phone right now saying they found the money! Martin is going to Villanova! The rush of emotions was so intense, I thought it might swallow me whole.
July 2003. Martin. The first line of the email was like rocket fuel. "We are pleased to offer you a full scholarship beginning with the 2003-2004 academic year." It propelled me from my seat. The breath I'd been holding for the past few months came barreling out of my mouth as I shouted, "Yes!" The cafe was already filled with people. Several turned to look at me like I was crazy. I did not care. "I am going to America," I shouted. "America!" I managed to sit down to read the rest of the message. It said a package was sent to Rebecca Mano on my behalf with all the paperwork necessary to secure my visa. I was so excited that I ran out without paying for the computer use. When I saw the shop owner come after me, I grabbed money from my pocket and shoved it into his hand and then started sprinting. The bus to the embassy took forever that day. There were plenty of seats, but I was too excited to keep still. I paced up and down the aisle, my heart pounding, my mind racing. As soon as I saw the white gleaming building in the distance, I pulled the cord to stop the bus and then ran down the street and through the wrought iron gates. "Congratulations, Martin," Rebecca said as I burst through her door. She handed me a FedEx package that was as heavy as a textbook. I pulled the cardboard strip and the contents fell onto my lap. "Villanova University" was written in navy blue across a thick cream-colored cardboard folder. I opened it and saw a version of the email I had just received. This was the official acceptance letter. This was real. I looked up at Rebecca, who was beaming. "A lot of people believe in you, Martin," she said, "including me." I thought of every single person who helped me get to this very place, sitting in the American embassy across from a blonde-haired and blue-eyed woman who spoke fluent Shona. The list was long, but it started with Caitlin. I had to share the news. "Shall we call them?" Rebecca asked. "Can we?" I said. She picked up the phone and started to dial.
July 2003. Caitlin. The news was still sinking in 2 hours later when the phone rang. I picked it up and said hello, but there was a funny echo, like the person on the other end was calling from the moon. "Caitlin?" I heard a few seconds later. "It's Martin." I started to shake. "You got the scholarship!" I shouted. My mother came running, so I put him on speakerphone and kept shouting, not because I thought he couldn't hear me, but because I was too excited to speak otherwise. "You need to be here by August 24th. My mom was now shouting too. "I just spoke to Candace. We know everything." "Mom?" Martin said. "Is that you?" "Yes, it is me," my mom said. "We are finally going to meet you." "My brother from another mother," I chimed in. That's what we had started calling Martin in my household.
"I look forward to that day," Martin said.
"Where are you?" I asked.
"Here in your embassy, with Rebecca," he said.
"Well, tell her that I will arrange for the airline tickets immediately," Mom said.
"In fact, may I speak with her?"
Mom got out her notepad and started making a list of things we needed to do as Martin's sponsors once he was here in the United States.
"You did it, Mom,"
I said after we hung up.
"Honey, none of this would have happened without you," she said. "Don't ever forget that."
We called my dad and Richie to tell them the good news. Wallace was in Colorado, working for a friend his parents had met in Victoria Falls. I called Damon last.
That is amazing news, Caitlin, he said. I'm so proud of you.
You're finally going to meet him, I said.
It will be like meeting a celebrity at this point, Damon said. I can't wait.
I can't either, I said. The very same day, my mom booked a one-way ticket for Martin. He would leave Zimbabwe on August 15th and arrive in Philadelphia the next day. After waiting nearly 6 years for this moment, a month felt like forever.
August 2003. Martin. I didn't have much time to get ready, so I returned to Victoria Falls to tell Tekla and Fanuel the great news and get all my vaccinations. From there, I went to Mutare to say goodbye to my family. I wanted to tell them about the scholarship in person. I also had to say goodbye. I had a feeling it would be a long time before I saw them again. I waited until my father and Nation came home that evening. We were all sitting around the fire, eating together. George was now 7, no longer a baby, but a grown boy. Lois was 12, the same age Caitlin was when she started writing me. She had maintained the number one position in her class since grade 1 without once slipping. And still sent my mother money to keep everyone in school, which meant Lois, too, would go to college if she wanted to. I was thinking of her when I stood up to make the announcement.
My Baba, I have news, I started. I will be leaving in a few weeks to study in America. I saw a smile grow across my mother's face, but it quickly turned to a frown when my father leapt from his seat and started to run around shouting,
Martin is going to the United States! He did it!
My mother started hissing, Keep quiet! This is no time to brag. Some things would never change. My father was so happy for me and this news, but my mother was superstitious. You don't brag about things ever, she scolded my father when he finally calmed down again. We cannot jinx this. Then she turned to me and said quietly and composed, We're very happy for you, Martin. You have made your poor parents so proud. Her eyes shone in the firelight, happy tears. I was scheduled to take the train back the very next day. Before I left, I took my mother aside. Anne had sent $100 to the Victoria Falls Western Union, with a note that said, for travel expenses. I priced the least expensive round-trip train ticket to Mutare and kept a small amount of money for food during the two-day journey, and gave the rest to my mother. This is for you, mother, from my American mother, I said, placing $96 in her hands. You keep this, son, she said. No, my, I said, wrapping her hand around the cash. Once I get to America, I will send more. But until I get there, I need to know you're going to be okay. My mother looked me in the eyes and said, Martin, we are fine. Because of you. Now go. I hugged her, and then my father placed both of his hands on my shoulders and said, I am so proud of you, son. So proud. I said goodbye to Nation and Simba, both grown men by then. It was hardest to say goodbye to Lois this time. I will miss you, brother, Lois said as she hugged me goodbye. Keep your grades up and you will soon come after me, I said. I returned to Vic Falls the first week in August to wait for the plane tickets to arrive. Each day felt an eternity. By August 11th, the tickets had still not arrived. I knew Caitlin and her mom had sent them, but that didn't help. The waiting kept me awake at night and fed the wildest dreams whenever I did drift off. In one, I was lying on a dirt floor in a hut similar to the one I shared with Frank in Chigodora. It was pouring rain. The water sounded like pounding hooves on the thatched roof, which I was convinced would collapse at any moment. Suddenly, water started seeping in from the sides and rising up from the floor. When it reached my face, I startled awake, drenched with sweat. I looked around and was relieved I was not in Chigodora or even Chisamba Singles, but still in the guest room at Wallace's house. Still, I couldn't shake the feeling that the lost ticket was a sign that this was not meant to be. That morning at breakfast, Tekla informed me a prophet was coming to see me. In Zimbabwe, prophets are like witch doctors. They can foretell the future. My mother made my father see one many years ago before I was born when he was misbehaving. That meeting, she claimed, cured him of his womanizing. I didn't entirely believe in their powers, but they are hugely popular in my country. People turned to witch doctors more often than regular doctors, and many friends and family members claimed that it worked. I was so desperate at this point, I was willing to put aside my skepticism and try anything. The prophet arrived dressed in a robe. His silver hair was clumped into dreadlocks, steel wool snakes slithering down his back. We sat in the living room, and I told him my troubles. He grabbed my hands and started to chant with his eyes closed. When he started speaking gibberish, I was so terrified that I closed my eyes as well. His entire body started shaking violently as he kept chanting. I cracked open my eyes and saw that his were open too, but rolling in the back of his head. He started moaning and sounded like an animal in heat. The shaking grew more intense until finally he let go of my hands with such ferocity that I fell backward. When I regained my composure, the prophet was sitting quietly with his hands folded in his lap.
"Your aunt doesn't want you to go," he said. "She has a bone to chew with your mother, so she placed a hex on you."
I had never met my aunt, but I know she stayed behind in the rural area and was worse off than my mother was. I thought of the topless women I saw in Chigodora and of Enough, the young girl who walked 7 kilometers to get to school. I thought of all the people in Zimbabwe who were struggling, who deserved the chance I was being given. "What can I do?" I asked.
"Let us pray," the prophet said.
I grabbed his hands and closed my eyes, and I made a litany of silent promises. If those tickets came, if I was allowed on that plane, if I actually made it to the United States to study, I'd never forget those who couldn't go with me. I would always remember Enough and my mother. When I opened my eyes, I saw the prophet staring at me.
"That's all you can do," he said.
Afterward, I was so exhausted that I went upstairs and fell asleep. It was the middle of the day, but I was so tired that I slept straight through dinner and until the following morning. It was a sound, restful sleep, the first in a very long time.
August 12, 2003. Caitlin. FedEx claimed that its 48-hour guarantee did not apply to Africa. My mother was livid. When I left for the pizza parlor at noon on August 12th, she was on the phone screaming at them. And when I got back later at night, she was pleading with the consolidator whom she'd bought the ticket from. "We already paid for it," she said. "Can't they reissue one at the airport?" I couldn't hear the response, but I knew it wasn't good when my mother shouted, "Thank you for nothing," and slammed down the phone. My father arrived moments later. "How is it going?" he asked. "Horribly," she said. Her voice was scratchy. "I'm at my wit's end. I already called Villanova to say he might not get here in time." "What did they say?" I asked, alarmed that it had come to this. "That they would hold his spot until January," my mother said. "But Martin can't wait that long. He needs to come now." "Let me make a few calls," my dad said. We ate dinner first, and then my father took over the phone, starting with the consolidator and then working the airlines and FedEx. At 1 a.m., he was still on the phone. It was 7 a.m. in Vic Falls. My mom thought we should call Martin to tell him the news. "What news?" I said, exasperated. "There is no news." "Tell him to go to the airport," my father said. "He's getting on that plane."
August 14th, 2003. Matin. My flight was scheduled to leave in 3 hours when the phone rang. Tekla jumped to get it. She then handed the receiver to me. It was Anne.
Mom?
I said, relieved. Am I coming?
We're still working on it, she said.
I could tell she had been crying, and that started my own tears. I was so stupid to believe that these voodoo rituals might work, and angry that I allowed myself to think they would. The tears were now stinging the backs of my eyes. I handed the phone to Tekla and ran up to my room. I couldn't cry in front of Wallace's parents. It was too undignified. As soon as I was able to shut the bedroom door, I fell onto my bed and buried my head beneath my pillow. The sounds that came from my belly were as primal and terrifying as the prophets. They hurt my throat as they clawed their way up and out. 10 minutes later, there was a knock at the door. I wiped my face dry before opening it. Fanuel and Tekla were there. Get your things. We're taking you to the airport, they said. How come? I asked, confused. We're not sure how, but you're getting on that plane, Fanuel said. I grabbed the few things I was taking, my money belt with all my paperwork, a toothbrush, and one of the very first photos of Caitlin, in which she is wearing her mother's sun hat. I placed the picture with my passport in the money belt and followed Tekla and Fanuel downstairs into the car. They had already packed a suitcase of African art for me to bring to Anne, who would send it to another friend in the US to sell, to raise funds for Wallace. Wallace's father drove so fast I thought we might actually crash. We now had less than an hour before my flight left. We pulled into the airport and went to the British Airways desk to explain the situation. The attendant pointed us toward the manager's office down the corridor. The manager was on the phone when we arrived. Fanuel knocked on her window. We knew this was rude, but the flight was boarding. There wasn't time for manners. She looked up from her desk and waved us in. Martin Gander? She said. Yes, I answered, stunned. I'm talking to a man who claims he's your American father, she said. The hex had been lifted. 5 minutes later, I walked outside onto the tarmac with a ticket in my hand. I was the last person to board the small jet to Johannesburg. I took my seat by the window and waved at Tekla and Fanuel, who waited to make sure I got on the plane. Welcome to British Airways Flight 429. The stewardess announced as the propellers outside started to whir. Please prepare for takeoff. I had never been on a plane before and had no idea what that meant. So I looked around at the other passengers. There were only 30 or so people on board, most of them white men in business suits. A few were likely tourists, I guessed, based on their khaki pants and matching shirts. There was one other black guy a few years older than me. Copying the others, I snapped my seatbelt on and tugged it extra tight. As the plane began to move, I held onto the armrest with both hands, my knuckles straining through my skin. When the nose of the plane tilted upward, I thought I might throw up the meal I had eaten at Tekla and Fanuel's house earlier that morning. I closed my eyes and prayed. I opened them when the stewardess announced that it was fine to walk around. All these people snapped off their seatbelts and got up to get books or stretch or use the restroom. I looked out the window and saw clouds and blue skies forever. I closed my eyes again and did not open them until we had landed safely in Johannesburg. The airport was the busiest place I'd ever seen. All these people, many talking with funny accents or in languages I had never heard before. There were signs with lists of flight numbers followed by the names of exotic places they were heading to. Tekla had given me $10 to get snacks. I saw a McDonald's and got very excited. Some of the wealthier kids from Maris Brothers had bragged about it. So I walked up to the counter and bought my very first hamburger. It cost $8, but I did not care. It was delicious. I went in search of my next flight, but did not know how to find it. My ticket had so many numbers on it, but I was not sure which ones corresponded with the flipping and flashing board. So when I saw the one black guy from my Victoria Falls flight walk by, I asked him for help. As it turned out, he was heading to Paris as well, where his father was a diplomat. We walked to the gate together and then waited for the flight to board. When he had to use the bathroom, I followed him. I didn't want to get lost. That was a huge plane. I watched movies, ate food served on very fancy trays, and wished I could keep the cozy blanket and pillow they offered all the passengers. We arrived in Paris, and once again, I didn't want to take any chances. This time, I asked the attendant to bring me to the next gate. My flight was not for a few hours, but it did not matter. I wasn't going to risk it. I just stayed there, not moving. Once the flight began to board, I was the first person in line. The next stop was Philadelphia.
August 15th, 2003. Caitlin. I didn't wake up that morning, because I never went to sleep. I stayed awake all night, tracking each of Martin's flights online. The day before, we made a poster that said, "Welcome to America, Martin," with bubble letters, which I colored in with red magic markers. I laid that in the trunk of my mom's car that morning, and then climbed into the back seat. My grandparents, Nan and Pop, drove their own car, so I had the entire seat to myself. I didn't invite Damon to come along. I had been waiting for this moment for 6 years, which was three times as long as I had known Damon. This meant too much to me to share with anyone but my family. Damon was pissed, and I didn't care. We arrived an hour early and camped out as close to the international flight exit as possible, right next to the swinging doors that led down the long hallway to customs. Each time a new wave of people arrived, I would pick up my poster. "Who's Martin?" an elderly man asked my mom. "Our African son," my mom answered, beaming. He looked utterly confused, but we didn't care. We had already told everyone on our street that Martin was coming. We were hosting a welcome to the neighborhood barbecue the following day. That evening, our closest relatives were coming to finally meet Martin. Everyone was excited, but no one more than I. We'd been there for an hour when Paris flight passengers started coming through. We knew because I kept asking, "What flight were you on?" I started counting people. When I hit 120, I got nervous. "What if he got stuck in France?" I asked my mom. "He's here," she said. "I can feel it." We kept peering down the hallway until it was just a trickle. And then no one. My stomach did a somersault. Something must be wrong. I was just about to go find an airline representative to make sure he had gotten on the flight when I saw a young black man emerge. As he got closer, his face erupted into the biggest smile ever. "That's him!" I cried. I was standing on one side of the plastic barrier that corralled the arriving passengers in one direction. He didn't even get to walk around it. I just reached over and grabbed him. We stood there hugging right over the fence. "You made it," I said.
"I did,"
Martin answered. The crowd of people around us waiting for their loved ones burst into applause as my mother rushed up and started snapping photos. Martin pulled back and said,
"Hi, Mom."
My mother burst into tears.
"We're so glad you are here."
My dad was crying too, as he held out his hand to shake Martin's.
"Welcome home, son."
Martin grabbed his hand and pulled him close. My grandfather was videotaping the whole thing, but that did not stop Martin from saying,
"Hi, Nan. Hi, Pop."
He knew who everybody was.
"Is that your only bag?"
Pop asked, pointing to the suitcase full of African art.
"This is for Wallace," Martin explained. "I told him just to come with the clothes on his back and we'd take care of the rest," my mom said.
"I have this,"
Martin said, pulling a toothbrush out of his back pocket. We all laughed. On our way home, we took a slight detour to drive by Villanova. The stone buildings looked majestic against the green, carpet-like lawn.
"That's where you're heading, Martin," Mom said.
August 15th, 2003. Martin. Hearing Caitlin say, "You made it," when we first embraced, made me realize this was real. For so many years, I thought I had conjured her. But here she was, as beautiful as I imagined, but much taller. She towered over me, no longer the 12-year-old girl with jewelry on her teeth that I first met 6 years ago. I wouldn't wake up in Chigodora or Chisamba Singles or Victoria Falls in a sweat. I had made it. As I was telling her about all my adventures, I saw that the girl who became my best friend in her letters was the woman sitting right next to me in the car. I still couldn't believe it, but I felt immediately at ease with her. Anne and Rich were asking questions from the front seat, smiling, so loving as well. She got this demeanor from both parents, I thought. They drove me by Villanova's campus, and it took my breath away. It was difficult to imagine I would be walking across that campus as an American student in less than 2 weeks. I could barely believe I was sitting there in the back of a 4x4 Jeep next to Caitlin. We pulled into their driveway, which I immediately recognized from the photos Caitlin had sent me. Richie came out to embrace me.
"My African brother," Richie said. "Very cool to meet you."
Caitlin took me inside and showed me around. They had set up a room for me in the basement where my dear friend Wallace had spent many nights. We called him after I showered. He was still in Colorado finishing his summer there. I would see him in a week or so. Then Caitlin said, "Let's go." She wanted to take me shopping at the legendary mall to get some things for my new American life. Walking into the glimmering palace with its magic sliding glass doors and gusts of cool air was everything I had imagined and more. The smells of sweet cinnamon and fried food overwhelmed me as we walked through what Caitlin called the food court. We shared something called a Cinnabon, and to this day, I have never eaten anything that delicious. Then she took me shopping. That I found overwhelming. To start, her father gave her his credit card. This was a new concept, that a small piece of plastic could purchase so many things. Caitlin bought me pants and shorts, t-shirts and long-sleeve shirts, flip-flops, sunglasses and more. I kept saying it was unnecessary, but soon just gave up. When she picked out not one but three belts, I had to say something. "I only have one waist," I said. I had never witnessed such excess, not even at Marist Brothers. Eventually I just went along with it, like I was in a dream, or an American movie, like the ones I'd watched sitting on my brother's shoulders and peering through a window all those years before in Chisamba Singles. Back home, Caitlin insisted I put on a new outfit for dinner, my first with my American family. When I came downstairs in my chinos and button-down shirt, everyone erupted in applause. The feeling reminded me of my first day slipping into my uniform at Marist Brothers. But this was even bigger. I was dressed now as an American student. My dream had been realized. I sat down at the table, which my American mother had covered in food. A meat dish she called pot roast with potatoes and carrots that made my mouth water with its rich smell. The bowl of salad was so large I could wrap both my arms around it, and there was a small spinning device next to it with an assortment of bottles that Caitlin called dressing. I had never heard of that word, nor was I the slightest bit hungry. I was still full from the Cinnabon and too ecstatic to eat. But I helped myself to a bit of everything. I wanted to taste it all. Each bite was further proof that this was real. I was in Hatfield with my American family, wearing my new clothes and about to go to university. The next day, Anne and Rich hosted a party for me and invited all of Caitlin's relatives and neighbors. I met aunts and uncles and cousins who greeted me as if I were a long-lost relative who had finally come home. After we ate, Anne stood up to make a speech. She introduced me to the family formally, and as she did, her voice grew wobbly, shaking with emotion. This stirred something in me. It brought me back from the high-in-the-sky feeling I had had ever since I boarded the plane in Paris. It reconnected me to the ground and to the fact that I was standing next to my best friend in her backyard in Hatfield, Pennsylvania. Anne paused mid-sentence to collect herself, and I began to speak. It was not rehearsed or even intended. These words came from deep inside me, waiting to emerge. I just want to thank you. You really don't understand what part you have played in my life and in the lives of people who are dependent on me. This is going to bring a great change to my family. It has always been my dream to go to college. It will give me a platform to exploit my potential and get some help to my family and friends in Zimbabwe. I just want to hope that God will give you maximum blessings. I felt Caitlin squeeze my hand, and I squeezed back. After 6 years of imagining what it would be like to see her, to hug her, to hear her laugh, to hold her hand, here she was, my best friend from afar, now standing right next to me. Epilogue. March 5th, 2008. Martin. I clinked a champagne glass to get everyone's attention. I would like to say a few words, I said, rising from the table to face Caitlin, who looked more radiant than ever before. I'm so happy that you have met Dima. Not only do you have a wonderful new husband, but I now have another brother. Her face, already set in a smile, went a slight pinkish color as she raised her glass toward me and then turned to kiss the man she had just married.
"Hear, hear!"
Wallace shouted. He was sitting across the table from me, next to Richie, our other brother from another mother. This is what we call each other still to this day. A few weeks earlier, Caitlin had phoned me in Manhattan, where I was living and working, to say she was going to marry Dimitri, a guy she had met on a cruise with her parents the year before. It was a quick engagement, but I knew this was a relationship that would last. Dima was different from Caitlin's previous boyfriends. He and I shared a similar worldview, perhaps because he came from a faraway place like me. He was from Belarus, a country in Eastern Europe. We both saw that Caitlin's beauty was way more than skin deep. He saw her generosity and kindness, and was not threatened by it. He is a good man. Watching him exchange vows with Caitlin earlier that day, I got a bit choked up. Caitlin and I had already shared so many milestones, and still have many ahead. I did not know then that I would go on to do my MBA at Duke, or that Caitlin would finish her nursing degree, as she had planned since she was 16, or give birth to a beautiful baby girl. All I knew was that we both had witnessed so many of each other's dreams come true. This day was another in a long list of special moments I got to share with her, starting with the very first letter she had sent 11 years earlier. I sat back down and looked around the table. Anne had happy tears streaming down her face, and Rich was so proud I thought his head would pop off. Nan and Pop were beaming, as was Grandpa Stoichitz. Richie was there with his wife, Jenny Lee, as was Wallace with his, Doreen. There was so much happiness at that one table. I only wish that my family back in Zimbabwe could be there as well. I kept in touch with everyone back home through letters and phone calls. In fact, as soon as I was settled at Villanova, I got a job in the admissions office and told Anne that I wanted to take over sending money to my parents. She had done enough, but she insisted on sending money to them the first year so that I could focus on my studies. I began saving and got a second part-time job at Taco Bell to earn more. That summer, I got a full-time job working for an insurance company, then continued to work and study during the following school year as well. It took some time, but finally I was able to save enough to buy my parents a new house in Mutare. They moved out of Chisamba Singles the same year I graduated from Villanova. Knowing that my mother has a water faucet in her own home and a bathroom with a toilet and her very own bed brings me peace. It makes the richness of my new American life all that more enjoyable. To this day, I continue to send money home to my parents, and I made sure that my siblings stayed in school no matter what. I kept my promise to my mother, the one I made right before I left for Victoria Falls and Villanova, that even though I was leaving her, it was only to be a better son to her and my father, and the best brother to my siblings. My dream to come to America was never for me alone. Lois remained number one in her class and is planning to come to college in the United States. I promised her she would, just as Caitlin had promised me that I would. Soon my sisters will meet for the first time. My family and Caitlin's stopped being two separate families a long time ago. It started with a letter, and then all of our lives were changed forever.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of I Will Always Write Back, How One Letter Changed Two Lives, written by Caitlin Alafarenka and Martin Gonda, with Liz Welsh, read by Chukwudi Iwuji and Emily Bauer, produced by Cheryl Smith, directed by Jared O'Connell, post-production by Beat Street Productions. I Will Always Write Back is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2015 by Caitlin Alafarenka and Martin Gonda. Audio production copyright 2015 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook without the permission of the publisher constitutes unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.